This is Audible.
Theodore Rex by Edmund Morris. Copyright 2001 by Edmund Morris. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. This book is read by Jonathan Mayrose. Prologue, 14-16 September, 1901. Saturday. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States without knowing it at 2:15 in the morning of 14 September, 1901. He was bouncing in a buckboard down the rain-swept slopes of Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. Constitutionally, not so much as a heartbeat impeded the flow of power from his assassinated predecessor to himself. Practically, more than 400 miles of mud and rails still separated him from William McKinley's death chamber in Buffalo, where preparations for an emergency inauguration were already underway. For all Roosevelt knew, he was still vice president, yet he already realized that he would soon assume supreme responsibility. Yesterday's telegrams, relayed up the mountain by telephone operators, riders, and runners, had documented the spread of gangrene through his bullet-ridden chief. The president is critically ill. His condition is grave. Oxygen is being given. Absolutely no hope. The last telegram to reach Roosevelt's vacation cabin in Upper Tahawus had been urgent enough to banish all thought of waiting for clearer weather. The president appears to be dying, and members of the cabinet in Buffalo think you should lose no time coming. So, shortly before midnight, he had kissed his wife and children goodbye and begun the descent to North Creek Station, at least a 7-hour drive, even by day. He was now, at the moment of his ascension, halfway through the second stage of his journey, some 5 miles north of Aden Lair Lodge, where a new wagon and fresh horses awaited him. He sat alone on the passenger seat, shrouded against splashes of mud in a borrowed raincoat several sizes too big. His favorite hat, a broad-brimmed slouch pulled well over his ears, kept some of the drizzle off his spectacles. Not that he could see anything beyond the buckboard's tossing circle of lamplight. Nor had he much to say. Since leaving Lower Tahawus, indeed, he had hardly spoken a word to the lanky youth in front of him. From time to time, he muttered to himself. Sincere, if slight, grief for McKinley, a cold-blooded politician he had never much cared for, struggled in Roosevelt's breast with more violent emotions regarding the assassin, Leon Czolgosz. In his opinion, those bullets at Buffalo had been fired not merely at a man, but at the very heart of the American Republic. They were an assault upon representative government and civilized order. Unable to contain his rage, he leaned forward and blurted an excoriation of Czolgosz into the rain. If it had been I who had been shot, he wouldn't have gotten away so easily. I'd have guzzled him first. Meanwhile, in Washington, Secretary of State John Hay sat alone, weeping. For hours he had heard newsboys shrieking outside his library window, "Extra, extra, all about the president dying." Aging and increasingly hypochondriacal, Hay had once worked for Abraham Lincoln and James Garfield, and seen them both assassinated. This third assassination, compounded by the recent death of his own son, was enough to extinguish all desire to go on living in an alien century. But duty had to be done. When the final knell sounded across 16th Street, he wrote a telegram officially informing Theodore Roosevelt that McKinley was dead. He ordered it sent to North Creek Station. At about 3:30, the lights of Aden Lair Lodge appeared in the mist. The landlord, Mike Cronin, was waiting outside with his rig. Roosevelt climbed down onto the wooden landing. "Any news?" "Not a word." Cronin spoke awkwardly, uncertain how to address his passenger. "Jump in right away and we'll be off." He fumbled with a lantern. Roosevelt said, "Here, give it to me," and joined him on the driver's seat. The new horses, two big black Morgans, started off swiftly. Cronin was an expert whip and hoped to break his own daylight record of just under 2 hours to North Creek. The horses knew every curve of the 16-mile road, but the descent grew slippery and one of them stumbled. Conscious of the precious value of his cargo, Cronin dragged on the reins. "Oh, that doesn't matter," Roosevelt exclaimed. "Push ahead." Most of the time the road was invisible, except when log bridges drummed suddenly under the buckboard's wheels, and errant boulders loomed out of the mud, necessitating detours. Roosevelt kept holding his watch to the lantern. "Hurry up, go faster." Their speed increased on the steep descent. Cronin worried aloud about skidding off a bend and falling hundreds of feet into the bogs beneath. But Roosevelt was calm. "If you're not afraid, I am not." Since puberty, he had taught himself to pluck the flower safety out of the nettle danger. Although his physical courage was by now legendary, it was not a natural endowment. He had been a timid child in New York City, cut off from schoolboy society by illness, wealth, and private tutors. Inspired by a leonine father, he had labored with weights to build up his strength. Simultaneously, he had built up his courage by sheer dint of practicing fearlessness. With every ounce of new muscle, with every point scored over pugilistic, romantic, and political rivals, his personal impetus, likened by many observers to that of a steam train, had accelerated. Experiences had flashed by him in such number that he was obviously destined to travel a larger landscape of life than were his fellows. He had been a published author at 18, a husband at 22, an acclaimed historian and New York State Assemblyman at 23, a father and a widower at 25, a ranchman at 26, a candidate for mayor of New York at 27, a husband again at 28, a civil service commissioner of the United States at 30. By then he was producing book after book and child after child, and cultivating every scientist, politician, artist, and intellectual of repute in Washington. His career had gathered further speed. Police Commissioner of New York City at 36, Assistant Secretary of the Navy at 38, Colonel of the 1st U.S. Volunteer Cavalry, the Rough Riders, at 39. At last, in Cuba, had come the consummating crowded hour. A rush, a roar, the sting of his own blood, a surge toward the sky, a smoking pistol in his hand, a soldier in light blue doubling up neatly as a jackrabbit. When the smoke cleared, he had found himself atop Kettle Hill, on the heights of San Juan, with a vanquished empire at his feet. From that viewpoint, the path to the presidency looked clear. Returning home a hero, Roosevelt had been elected governor of New York within 2 weeks of his 40th birthday. He had toured the Midwest and been greeted everywhere as if he was a presidential candidate. Dutifully supporting William McKinley for renomination in 1900, he had begun to assemble his own campaign organization for 1904. Everything in his hard philosophy assured him that the White House would be his one day. He had fought all his life for supreme power, for that highest form of success which comes to the man who does not shrink from danger, from hardship, or from bitter toil. Yet just when his momentum seemed irresistible, there had come that sickening sideways pull into the vice presidency, followed by a political dead halt. And now, this even more violent lurch back on course. His path ran, appropriately, past a cemetery, the churchyard of Minerva. Wet gravestones gleamed as the buckboard raced through the village. Beyond, slopes gave way to swamps, and the road began to flatten out. A pallor in the mist signaled dawn. At 5 o'clock, Cronin announced that they were only 2 miles from North Creek. Roosevelt ordered a stop to let the horses blow. He straightened his tie and smoothed his suit, saying there might be some notables waiting at the station. The final dash was dramatic enough to satisfy Roosevelt's love of stagey arrivals. Sun-reddened cliffs disclosed the racing floodwater of the Hudson River, and Cronin's horses, refreshed by their brief pause, thundered thrillingly over the bridge into town. The noise acted as a drum roll, heralding their entrance onto Main Street. Voices shouted, "There he comes!" The buckboard flew past darkened house fronts and stoops, still bare of the morning milk. Its wheels had hardly come to rest at the depot when Roosevelt jumped down to discover, if not notables, at least a small crowd of local citizens, and the neat, bespectacled figure of his secretary, William Loeb, Jr. A special train stood waiting. The time on the station clock read 5:22. Loeb wordlessly handed over John Hayes' telegram from Washington. Roosevelt unfolded it. There was a moment of silence, broken only by the impatient hissing of the locomotive. He stared at the 8 words in his hand. "The President died at 2:15 this morning." Looking suddenly worn and weary, he pocketed the paper and strode across the wet platform. A private car was ready for him. He darted up the steps, turned, and waved once. Loeb followed him inside. The train began to move before the door swung shut behind them. Roosevelt's first words, as he settled into his plush seat, were that he wanted to get to Buffalo as soon as possible. Loeb had anticipated this wish and secured the fastest locomotive on the Delaware and Hudson Railroad. 3 years of experience had taught him that his boss was always in a hurry. That dart up the train steps was typical. He could remember Governor Roosevelt doing the same, up all 77 stairs of the state capitol in Albany. Mount Marcy's cloud banks began to lift, and the other peaks glowed in the sun as the special raced south toward Albany. But fog lingered in the Hudson Valley, and the crew of the locomotive could only trust in its emergency right-of-way. Roosevelt dictated a series of telegrams, including one to Edith that was as terse as Hayes to himself. Darling Edie always knew what to do. She and the children would find their own way down the mountain and home to Oyster Bay. His work finished, he dismissed Loeb and sat staring out into the flying mists. At about 7 o'clock, there was a scream of brakes and a crash that shook the whole train. It jarred to a halt. Word came back that the locomotive had collided with a handcar in the fog. 2 men were nearly killed. Roosevelt did not need to be told what might have happened had the handcar been another train. For 15 minutes, while a gang cleared the track, he had leisure to ponder the mortal vulnerabilities of power. This accident was nothing compared to the threat of another Chalgosh lurking in wait for him. Anarchism, that plague of European government, was a virulent strain in America, fed by social unrest, and fear of it was spreading. Just the other day, an old black man had taken him by the hand and said, "Look out they don't get you, Mr. Vice President." Personally, Roosevelt was not worried about assassination. If a bullet came from behind, he could do nothing about it, and would go down into the darkness, that being his fatalistic image of death. If the attack was frontal, as on McKinley, he had confidence in the abnormal speed of his reflexes and the power of his 185-pound body. Last winter in Colorado, he had leaped off his horse into a pack of hounds, kicked them aside, and knifed a cougar to death. What a great fight that had been. His larger concern was the effect of morbid microorganisms like Chalgosh on the American body politic. As president, he intended to war with ruthless efficiency against them, just as he had warred against his own diseases in youth. Roosevelt had never hesitated to identify himself with the United States. Personal and patriotic pride throbbed as one in his breast. When, accepting the vice presidency, he saluted a new century big with the fate of mighty nations, it was clear which nation and which leader he believed would ultimately prevail. Is America a weakling to shrink from the world work of the great world powers? No. The young giant of the West stands on a continent and clasps the crest of an ocean in either hand. Our nation, glorious in youth and strength, looks in the future with eager eyes and rejoices as a strong man to run a race. Youth, size, and strength. These things, surely, would render America proof against the anarchic strain. At 42, he, Theodore Roosevelt, was the youngest man ever called upon to preside over the United States, itself the youngest of the world powers. The double symbolism was pleasing. He refused to look at the future through the dun-colored mists of pessimism. Even now, as his train jerked into motion again, the fog outside was evaporating into a clear sky, and light flooded the Hudson Valley. Black night had given way to bright morning. Soon he would take the oath as president of the mightiest republic upon which the sun has ever shone. At 8:02, the train stopped briefly at Albany. Loeb emerged to tell waiting reporters that Roosevelt was very tired and would have no statement to make until after his inauguration. Breakfast was whisked aboard, along with the morning newspapers. Within 5 minutes, the special was on its way again, accelerating to 60 miles an hour. Roosevelt, sucking down some badly needed coffee, had as much to learn from death extra dispatches as millions of other Americans that morning. The president's last hours were chronicled in poignant detail. Here was Senator Mark Hanna, who loved McKinley like a brother, dropping onto gouty knees and pleading, "William, William, speak to me." Here were doctors squirting stimulants into the dying man's heart to shock him into momentary recognition of his wife. And here, framed in black, were the president's last words, pious enough to heave all the bosoms in Christendom. "Nearer, my God, to thee, his will be done." In rude contrast, other columns celebrated the tremendous energy, superb health, and strenuous life of McKinley's successor. Roosevelt did not need to read these, nor the potted biographies, listing his many qualifications for office. He was more interested in analyses of his political situation. The New York World announced that he had already definitely fixed in his mind the nomination for 1904. His old foe, Senator Hanna, chairman of the Republican National Committee, would have to be gotten out of the way somehow. The newspaper was silent as to Roosevelt's chances of election. No vice president succeeding to the presidency through death had yet won another term in his own right. The New York Press predicted that John Hay would resign as Secretary of State, followed by Treasury Secretary Lyman J. Gage. Roosevelt did not like this forecast, no matter how genuine the desire of both secretaries, ailing, old, and bereaved, to retire. He could not afford to have them decamp before he reached the White House. It would look like a vote of no confidence. There might be serious repercussions on Wall Street, where Hay was seen as an aggressive promoter of American commercial interests abroad, and Gage as guardian of republicanism's holiest grail, the protective tariff. A remarkable consensus of Democratic and Republican editorial writers held that Roosevelt would be as conservative as McKinley. The very unanimity of this opinion seemed contrived, as if to soothe a nervous stock market. The financial pages reported that severe shocks, feverish trading, and heavy declines had hit Wall Street on Friday when the gold-dollar president began to die. Roosevelt knew little about money. It was one of the few subjects that bored him, but even he could see that one false move this weekend might bring about a real panic on Monday. As the news of McKinley's death flashed around the world, members of Roosevelt's circle of acquaintance could reflect with grim satisfaction on the many times they had predicted the presidency for him. In Dresden, his German tutor claimed first honors. "He will surely one day be a great professor," she remembered telling his mother. "Or, who knows, he may even become President of the United States." In Albany, an old girlfriend mused on the strange prophetic quality in Theodore. Ever since her first crush on him, Fanny Parsons had felt a mystical certainty that he would lead his country to world power. In Dickinson, North Dakota, the editor of a cowboy newspaper recalled the young Roosevelt's complete lack of surprise at being told that he was destined for the White House. In Indianapolis, Benjamin Harrison's son reread a memo by the late president. Should Mr. Roosevelt aspire to become President of the United States, I believe that he will be successful. In London, a member of Parliament checked his diary entry for the day Roosevelt had been elected Vice President. This can only mean one thing, that the Almighty has decided to promote the good McKinley to the Vale of Tears. And in Arctic Norway, a traveling Henry Adams stared aghast at the wire dispatches from America. So Teddy is president. Is not that stupendous? Before such a career as that, I have no observations to make. Minds less fatalistic could view Roosevelt's career only as a crazy trajectory, like that of a bee smacking against many surfaces before buzzing into the open air. Some ward healer's notion to nominate the young aristocrat for the New York Assembly. The freak tragedy that drove him west. The chance encounter that brought him back. The overnight war that made him governor. His entrapment into the vice presidency. His liberation by an assassin. Horatio Alger could not get away with such a story. Yet there was no doubt that Theodore Roosevelt was peculiarly qualified to be president of all the people. Few, if any, Americans could match the breadth of his intellect and the strength of his character. A random survey of his achievements might show him mastering German, French, and the contrasted dialects of Harvard and Dakota Territory, assembling fossil skeletons with paleontological skill, fighting for an amateur boxing championship, transcribing bird song into a private system of phonetics, chasing boat thieves with a star on his breast and Tolstoy in his pocket, founding a finance club, a stockman's association, and a hunting conservation society, reading some 20,000 books and writing 15 of his own, climbing the Matterhorn, promulgating a flying machine, and becoming a world authority on North American game mammals. Any Roosevelt watcher could make up a different but equally varied list. If the sum of all these facets of experience added up to more than a geometric whole, implying excess construction somewhere, planes piling upon planes, then only he, presumably, could view the polygon entire. Thousands of people were milling on the platform of Exchange Street Station, Buffalo, when Roosevelt's train approached at 1:30 p.m., but the engineer, obeying security instructions, did not slacken speed. He continued west at full steam. 4 minutes later, the train drew up at Terrace Station, where a private carriage and 12 mounted policemen stood waiting in the sunshine. Roosevelt was down the steps of his car before the wheels stopped rolling. An hour's rest had cleared the tiredness from his face, but his eyes were troubled. Some onlookers shouted, "Hurrah for Teddy!" He silenced them with a glare and climbed into the waiting carriage. One of the policemen reached after him. "Colonel, will you shake hands with me?" Roosevelt recognized and briefly embraced a veteran of his regiment. Within 30 seconds, the cavalcade was on its way. Roosevelt's companion in the carriage was Ansley Wilcox, a Buffalo friend who had put him up on earlier, happier visits. Wilcox suggested that they go to his home at 641 Delaware Avenue for a quick lunch. McKinley's body, attended by a quorum of the cabinet, lay in the Milburn House, 1 mile farther uptown. The cavalcade moved too fast for crowds to form, so the sidewalks of Delaware Avenue were practically empty when they reached number 641. Roosevelt remembered the Wilcox mansion as one of Buffalo's most elegant houses, but today its white pillars were hideously swathed in black, drapes blinded every window, and veils of fading wisteria hung from the walls like widow's weeds. Averting his gaze, he hurried inside. Over lunch, he said that he had decided where he wanted to be sworn in. "Here." Wilcox protested that arrangements had been made to hold the ceremony at the Milburn House in a room below McKinley's corpse. "Don't you think it would be far better to do as the cabinet has decided?" Roosevelt was adamant. "No, it would be far worse." He would go there, he said, only to pay his respects. First, he must make himself presentable. By a fortunate coincidence, Wilcox was of similar size and build, so Roosevelt was able to borrow a frock coat, waistcoat, and striped trousers.
His bull-like neck presented no problem, as he had brought a fresh shirt and collar. The Rooseveltian head, however, proved too large for any of Wilcox's tall silk hats. John S. Scatcherd, a macrocephalic neighbor, entered the annals of history by lending his own capacious topper. A satin tie, fine watch chain, gloves, and gold-topped cane completed Roosevelt's furnishings. Bootblacks polished away the last traces of Adirondack mud from his person, and he emerged onto the porch at 2:30, lustrous from head to foot. Even now, the only spectators in Delaware Avenue were two platoons of mounted police, a knot of reporters, and a teenage girl. Roosevelt exploded with rage at the sight of the troopers. "I told you I did not want an escort," he roared at the state inspector general. He was clearly overwrought and had to be coaxed to accept a few troopers around his carriage. To swelling cries of, "Roosevelt is coming, Roosevelt is coming," the carriage sped north to Milburn House. He jumped out in precipitate fashion, then, recollecting himself, advanced across the lawn with bowed head. The dapper figure of George Bruce Cordelieu, McKinley's secretary, came out to meet him. Roosevelt removed his hat. They talked gravely for a few seconds. Cordelieu, whose normally sleek 40-ish features were ravaged with grief and exhaustion, explained that an autopsy was being performed upstairs. Roosevelt would not be able to see the body. Mrs. McKinley was too prostrated to receive him. Senator Hanna was nowhere to be seen. He had limped off, mumbling something about possible misconstruction if he attended the inaugural ceremony. Secretaries Hay and Gage were in Washington, looking after the government. The rest of the cabinet was waiting in the parlor. Hat in hand, Roosevelt followed Cordelieu inside. Six solemn figures rose to greet him. A voice called out, "The President of the United States." It was the first time he had heard the phrase in reference to himself, but its drama did not register, so intent was he upon behaving correctly. After formal handshakes, he stood listening to the familiar hoarse murmur of Elihu Root, Secretary of War. How often had this authoritative figure, this severe face under the ridiculous fringe, bent over him in fatherly advice. Root, the brutal friend to whom I pay the most attention, had been one of the group of eminent New Yorkers that supported his entry into politics 17 years ago. Root, lawyer without peer, had hornswoggled the Saratoga Convention into overlooking his technical ineligibility for the gubernatorial nomination. Time and again, the rising politician had submitted hot speeches to Root's icy scrutiny, always with bracing results. He even enjoyed the deadly Root wit, though it bruised his ego. Now, however, Roosevelt was senior. He politely rejected Root's recommendation of an inauguration on the spot, saying it would be more appropriate elsewhere. The secretary bowed assent. Returning to his carriage, Roosevelt was driven back the way he had come. Root and the other cabinet officers followed in separate carriages, with reporters running behind them. A strange hothouse glow filled Ansley Wilcox's green library as Roosevelt entered it alone. From now on, he would have to get used to deference whenever he crossed a threshold. The luminescence came from a stained glass window fringed with sunny ivy. He chose this bright spot for himself and watched the cabinet officers filing in. Cordelieu arranged them in arcs to left and right, while a federal judge, John R. Hazel, stood in the center of the room. Loeb, acting as doorman, admitted a selection of local dignitaries. Among them, Roosevelt recognized Senator Chauncey Depew, Republican New York, looking humble for once, doubtless regretting how he used to tease Teddy about wanting to be president. Next, Loeb beckoned in representatives of the three press agencies, and, in a final relaxation of proprieties, a small party of women. Some constitutional documents were given to Judge Hazel, who shuffled them into order. Roosevelt gazed around the library. A glint in his spectacles betrayed displeasure. Loeb came up inquiringly, and there was a whispered conversation in which the words "newspaper men" and "sufficient room" were audible. Hurrying outside, Loeb returned with 24 delighted scribes. They proceeded to report the subsequent ceremony with a wealth of detail unmatched in the history of presidential inaugurations. The library clock struck 3:30. Elihu Root muttered something urgent to Roosevelt, then took up his position. There was a moment of extreme quietness, broken only by the chirp of a sparrow in the window. Roosevelt half turned and gazed almost yearningly through the glass, a boy trapped in school. Root's voice reclaimed his attention. "Mr. Vice President, I..." The Secretary of War choked, sobbed, and for a full minute struggled to control himself. Roosevelt's face was stern, but as the suspense mounted, his cheek muscles began to twitch, and his right foot pawed the floor. At last, Root managed to continue. "I have been asked, on behalf of the cabinet of the late president, to request that, for reasons of weight affecting the administration of the government, you should proceed to take the constitutional office of the President of the United States." Roosevelt bowed, cleared his throat, and said waveringly, "I shall take the oath at once." He, too, seemed to be fighting tears, but his voice grew rapidly stronger. "And in this hour of deep and terrible national bereavement, I wish to state that it shall be my aim..." Here he shook his shoulders and pulled back his head. "To continue absolutely unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace, the prosperity, and the honor of our beloved country." This speech, the shortest inaugural anybody could remember, created a profound impression. It struck all present as pledge, platform, and policy all in one. Roosevelt spoke with characteristic passion, punctuating his words with dental snaps, as if biting the syllables out of the air. He seemed to vibrate with force, sincerity, and reverence for the memory of his predecessor. To one observer, he symbolized the magnificent moral and mental balance of the nation. His statement instantly solved the political and commercial crisis. Finance, in the person of John G. Milburn, grew calm. Industry, in the person of Chauncey Depew, was comforted. And government, in the persons of the cabinet officers, breathed a collective sigh of relief. Roosevelt was to receive worldwide praise for his few words, yet they were not original. Elihu Root had suggested, sotto voce, while the clock was chiming, that he declare his intention to continue unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace, prosperity, and honor of the country. Roosevelt's parrot memory had preserved the words intact. Judge Hazel clutched an inscribed parchment. "Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Theodore Roosevelt..." Roosevelt's arms shot up, fully extended. Throughout the oath, his hand remained high and steady, as if carved from marble. His face was drawn, and his eyes glittered. Depew was struck by the terrible earnestness with which he articulated every word. Yet even at this moment of ritual fidelity to the text of the Constitution, Roosevelt could not resist adding a personal flourish. "And thus I swear," he concluded, ejaculating the words like bullets. Then he bowed his head. 2 minutes ticked by, the room filled with an almost unbearable tension. Beads of sweat stood on Roosevelt's brow. Not until a third minute elapsed did he look up. "Mr. President," the judge said, holding out the certificate of oath, "please attach your signature." Roosevelt's pen scratched across the parchment. 43 persons stood in thrall until he dismissed them with a kingly nod. They trooped out dreamy-eyed, as from a perfect theatrical performance. "I have witnessed many of the world's pageants in my time," Senator Depew said afterward. "Fleets and armies, music and cannon, but they all seem to me tawdry and insignificant in the presence of that little company in the library of the Wilcox House in Buffalo." Roosevelt remained behind to shake hands with members of his cabinet. Asking them to prepare for an immediate meeting, he went into the hall to receive the farewells of departing guests. "God bless you, Mr. President. The whole country will pray for you, Mr. President." There were tears on many faces, but he seemed unmoved. A reporter was struck by Roosevelt's curious nervous tension, so at odds with his usual boyish good cheer. The cause of it was not at all any sense of the weight of his new position, but the reaction of a strong man to the idea that he was entering a domain where assassins lurked in the shadows and the ground might open at any moment under his feet. The cabinet meeting proceeded behind closed doors. Afterward, Roosevelt came out onto the porch to announce that all six officers had agreed to remain in their positions, at least for the present. He had similar assurances from his two absent secretaries, John Hay and Lyman Gage. This was true in the sense that both men had wired messages of support, but until he saw them in Washington, he hardly knew what their assurances were worth. Business completed, Roosevelt put on his borrowed silk hat. "Let's take a walk," he said to Elihu Root. "It will do us both good." A quartet of policemen fell into line behind him on the gravel path. Irritatedly, he shooed them away. "I do not want to establish the precedent of going about guarded." The policemen touched their helmets, retreated a yard or two, and followed as before. Roosevelt headed for the gate like an escaping bull, but found Delaware Avenue blocked by cordoned-off crowds. He was forced to take leave of Root in the street and marched back to the mansion in frustration. Refuge was at least available in the morning room, where Cortelyou had laid a desk with pencils, an exercise book, and a copy of Messages of the Presidents. Turning to a proclamation of President Arthur, Roosevelt drew the rough pad toward him. He began to scrawl his first presidential order, making 19 September a day of official mourning. "God in His infinite wisdom." The pencil hovered, then slashed back through the cliché. "A great and terrible bereavement," it wrote instead, "has come upon our nation." Roosevelt tried to make the last words more personal. "Has befallen our people. The President of the United States has been struck down." How to describe the act of assassination? "A foul and dastardly crime. The basest of all crimes. A crime so dastardly..." He struggled to reconcile his love of strong language with the need for dignified expression. It had always been thus with him, conflict between belligerence and civilized restraint, between animal brutality and human decency, between pessimism and optimism, or, as his perceptive friend Owen Wister put it, between what he knew and his wish not to know it. In youth, the aggressive impulse had predominated, but in maturity he had strengthened himself to a state of containment, like a volcano sheathed in hardened lava. For 3 years there had been no serious fissures. At any rate, his struggle today was brief. The sentences began to shape themselves into statesmanlike prose, and soon the pencil was moving confidently. "Now, therefore, I, Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States..." At 4 o'clock, word came that Mark Hanna's carriage was outside. Roosevelt hurried onto the porch and watched the old man descend, trembling on a cane. Hanna was clearly broken by the death of his adored William. He was pallid and stooped, and his piggy feet dragged in the gravel. "The senator," a reporter scribbled, "seems to have aged 10 years in the last 24 hours. With spontaneous grace, Roosevelt ran down to meet him, hand outstretched. Hanna was surprised and moved. Shifting his soft white hat and cane, he returned the gesture. "Mr. President, I wish you success and a prosperous administration, sir. I trust that you will command me if I can be of service." Roosevelt smiled and murmured a few sympathetic words about McKinley. He helped Hanna up the steps and said, "I want your friendship." Seated inside, Hanna resisted further blandishment. He said that he would support the Roosevelt administration only as long as it remained an extension of McKinley's. As to the question of the Republican presidential nomination in 1904, that was something for the future to decide. Roosevelt replied, "I understand perfectly," and escorted the senator back to his carriage. Hannah drove away without so much as a wave. That evening, George Cortelyou announced that there would be a private memorial service for McKinley at the Milburn House the next morning, Sunday. Roosevelt and his cabinet officers would attend and remain in Buffalo until Monday morning, when a funeral train would depart for Washington. On Tuesday, there would be further memorial exercises at the Capitol, followed by an internment ceremony Wednesday in Canton, Ohio. Mrs. McKinley would vacate the White House at her convenience. In the meantime, Roosevelt would stay at his sister's house on N Street. While Cortelyou talked, Roosevelt ate an early dinner, then went, exhausted, to bed. Sometime after midnight, in New York City, 300 miles away, John F. Schrank began to dream. He was 26 years old, short and reclusive. He lay above a saloon that had employed him once, before the Sunday closing crusade of Police Commissioner Theodore Roosevelt. Since that crusade, and because of it, Schrank believed, he had been unable to get a job. Now, as he dreamed, his shabby surroundings were transformed into a funeral parlor full of flowers. An open coffin stood before him. President McKinley sat up in it and pointed to a dark corner of the room. Schrank, peering, made out a man in monk's raiment. Under the cowl were the bespectacled features of Theodore Roosevelt. "This is my murderer," said McKinley. "Avenge my death." Schrank woke and checked his watch. 1:30 a.m. Almost immediately, he went back to sleep. McKinley did not speak to him again that night. Indeed, the appeal would not be renewed for another 11 years, until the same hour of the same night of the week, in another gruesome September. Sunday. Roosevelt awoke refreshed early the next morning. "I feel bully." He went out onto the porch for some air, unaware that he was being minutely observed through the fence. His tanned skin stretched over his jutting jaw. His teeth gleamed through thick, half-parted lips. His neck, too squat for a standing collar, merged with weightlifter shoulders, sloping 2 full inches to the tip of his biceps, and his chest pushed apart the lapels of his frock coat. He tugged at his watch chain with short, nervous fingers, shifting his small, square-toed shoes. Here, palpably, was a man of expansive force. When he breathed, the porch seemed to breathe with him. Breakfast, laced as usual by vast infusions of caffeine, served only to stoke Roosevelt's energy. A sheaf of congratulatory telegrams further stimulated him. One read simply, "Vive le roi." He managed to look solemn on the way to Milburn House, but his mind was seething with politics. During the memorial service, he caught sight of Herman H. Colesot, publisher of the Chicago Times-Herald, and whispered urgently, "I want to see you." Colesot followed him back to the Wilcox mansion. He was shown into the library and found Roosevelt exchanging compliments with a beaky, 40-ish professor from Princeton. "Woodrow, you know Colesot, don't you? Mr. Colesot, let me introduce you to Woodrow Wilson." The professor bowed out. Roosevelt got straight to the point. "I am going to make 2 changes in my cabinet that I know will please you," he said. Colesot began to preen. He was a journalist of large influence and even larger vanity. But what he heard did not please him at all. "I am going to let John Hay go and appoint Elihu Root Secretary of State," Roosevelt said. "I am also going to ask Lyman Gage for his resignation." Actually, Roosevelt had no intention of firing either Hay or Gage. On the contrary, he was worried by continued reports that they would resign as soon as he got to Washington. The presence in Buffalo of Colesot, who knew both men well, came as a godsend. Roosevelt had long since perfected the art of manipulating newspapermen. Colesot rose to his hearing like a trained seal. "Colesot, John Hay is an old friend of mine. What have you against Lyman Gage? Roosevelt, teeth snapping. He always gets his back up against the wall, and I can't get around him. Kohlsaat, don't you know I am responsible for Mr. Gage being in the cabinet? Yesterday, when you were sworn in, you issued a statement that you were going to carry on McKinley's policies, and now you propose to fire his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury? Roosevelt, after a pause, falsetto, old man, I am going to pay you the highest compliment I ever paid anyone in my life. I am going to keep both of them. Compounding the flattery, he invited Kohlsaat to accompany him to Washington the next day. The only other friend I have on the train is Elihu Root. Then, casually, Gage does not like me. I want you to wire him to meet you at your hotel on our arrival, and tell him that he must stay for a while at least. And I want you to see the Associated Press man, and ask him to send a dispatch that when we reach Washington tomorrow night, I am going to ask Hay and Gage to remain in the cabinet. Kohlsaat bustled off, feeling he had managed to sway the rods of power. Had he understood the subtleties of Rooseveltian press relations, he might have seen that he had been tricked into making a personal appeal to Gage. The AP dispatch would also forestall any possible resignation by Hay. Neither man could then quit without appearing disloyal to Roosevelt and to the unfinished agenda of William McKinley. Roosevelt's move was well-timed. Even now, in Washington, the Secretary of State was composing a letter that read like a valedictory. September 15, 1901. My dear Roosevelt, if the presidency had come to you in any other way, no one would have congratulated you with better heart than I. My sincere affection and esteem for you, my old-time love for your father, would he could have lived to see where you are, would have been deeply gratified. And even from the depths of the sorrow where I sit, with my grief for the president mingled and confused with that for my boy, so that I scarcely know, from hour to hour, the true source of my tears, I do still congratulate you not only on the opening of an official career which I know will be glorious, but upon the vast opportunity for useful work which lies before you. With your youth, your ability, your health and strength, the courage God has given you to do right, there are no bounds to the good you can accomplish for your country and the name you will leave in its annals. My official life is at an end. My natural life will not be long extended, and so, in the dawn of what I am sure will be a great and splendid future, I venture to give you the heartfelt benediction of the past. God bless you. Yours faithfully, John Hay. Monday. 16 September dawned so bright that Buffalo's heavy black drapery looked inconsequential, even tawdry, against the overwhelming blueness of lake and sky. A stiff breeze snapped thousands of half-mast flags. At shortly after 8:15, Roosevelt, escorted by a small group of mounted policemen, rolled down Delaware Avenue on his way to Exchange Street Station. Presently, wind-blown fragments of music heralded the approach of McKinley's cortege from City Hall. Roosevelt ordered his procession to follow at a respectful distance. He stood watching at the station entrance as soldiers unloaded the coffin and carried it inside. "Nearer, my God, to thee," sounded inevitably from the band. Mrs. McKinley was escorted onto the platform, a frail figure, almost hidden by black-clad relatives. Then Roosevelt stepped forward. He seemed surprised at the sight of a huge, mute crowd. Unthinkingly, he waved his hat. Before boarding the train, he groped for Herman Kohlsaat in the press party and hissed again in his ear, "Did you send that telegram to Gage?" The funeral train, courtesy of the Pennsylvania Railroad, consisted of two black-draped locomotives, one with a particularly sad whistle to steam ahead as pilot for the other, plus a baggage car, a saloon car, and five sumptuous Pullmans. Reporters were assigned to the first of these, Senator Hanna and other dignitaries to the second, Roosevelt and his cabinet to the third. The fourth carried George Cortelyou and members of the McKinley family. Officially speaking, Cortelyou was now Roosevelt's personal secretary, but as long as Mrs. McKinley depended on him, he was pleased to defer to Loeb. The fifth and final car, a glass observation parlor, acted as a catafalque. McKinley's coffin rode inside on a bed of flowers. At 8:57, the train began to move. Church bells tolled across the city. Thousands of onlookers crowded every platform, stairway, bollard, and bridge. From sheds and warehouses along the track, grimy workmen emerged to squint and stare. The avid scrutiny of all these eyes was too much for Roosevelt. He ordered the blinds drawn, but not so soon as to miss the sight of workmen hurrying back to their jobs after the train had passed them by. For a while he sat alone, waiting for the liberating sense of acceleration into open country. What he had just observed, evidence of America's passion for work, its impatient refusal to loiter a moment longer than necessary, was pleasing, if not surprising. For several years, both he and the world had been aware that the United States was the most energetic of nations. She had long been the most richly endowed. This first year of the new century found her worth $25 billion more than her nearest rival, Great Britain, with a gross national product more than twice that of Germany and Russia. The United States was already so rich in goods and services that she was more self-sustaining than any industrial power in history. Indeed, it could consume only a fraction of what it produced. The rest went overseas, at prices other exporters found hard to match. As Andrew Carnegie said, "The nation that makes the cheapest steel has other nations at its feet." More than half the world's cotton, corn, copper, and oil flowed from the American cornucopia, and at least one-third of all steel, iron, silver, and gold. Even if the United States were not blessed with raw materials, the excellence of her manufactured products guaranteed her dominance of world markets. Current advertisements in British magazines gave the impression that the typical Englishman woke to the ring of an Ingersoll alarm, shaved with a Gillette razor, combed his hair with Vaseline tonic, buttoned his Aero shirt, hurried downstairs for Quaker Oats, California Figs, and Maxwell House coffee, commuted in a Westinghouse tram, body by Fisher, rose to his office in an Otis elevator, and worked all day with his Waterman pen, under the efficient glare of Edison light bulbs. "It only remains," one Fleet Street wag suggested, "for us to take American coal to Newcastle." Behind the joke lay real concern. The United States was already supplying beer to Germany, pottery to Bohemia, and oranges to Valencia. As a result of this billowing surge in productivity, Wall Street was awash with foreign capital. Carnegie calculated that America could afford to buy the entire United Kingdom and settle Britain's national debt in the bargain. For the first time in history, transatlantic money currents were thrusting more powerfully westward than east. Even the Bank of England had begun to borrow money on Wall Street. New York City seemed destined to replace London as the world's financial center. It was hard to believe that the United States had struggled out of a depression only 5 years before. Prosperity was everywhere for Roosevelt to see, if not through drawn blinds at the moment, then memorably on his recent trip to Minnesota. The weather-stained barns of poorer days, the drab farmhouses and blistered grain elevators, were pristine with new paint. He had seen corrugated dirt giving way to asphalt, rotten boardwalks smoothing to stone, shards of shacks pushed aside by new red brick houses. Not so long ago, Midwestern towns had glowed dully at night, if they glowed at all. Now they were constellations of electricity, bright enough to wake the sleeping traveler. Equally bright, by day, were silver threads of irrigation in the green fields, and new steel-roofed sheds and schoolhouses. Behind Roosevelt now, he could reopen his blinds as the train gathered speed, Buffalo receded into a cyclorama of modern industrial development. Louis Sullivan's skyscraper, the Prudential Building, bespoke a modern, defiantly native school of architecture. Scores of dockside cranes dipped and reared like hungry pterodactyls. Horseless carriages trailed plumes of dust and engine smoke in and out of town. Hydroelectric plant towers loomed against the mists of Niagara, sending invisible thrills of power through the industrial suburbs. Wherever the sun shone, it glinted on countless telephone and telegraph wires, weaving block to block in warps and woofs of copper. Trees soon barred Buffalo from sight, but the wires pursued the train effortlessly, rising and falling from pole to pole. Already, news of Roosevelt's departure had flashed along them, flickering into every corner of the land. Wires like these, connecting with other wires in Albany, and yet more wires in the Adirondacks, had summoned him from the peak of Mount Marcy. In about 12 hours, they would broadcast the details of his arrival in Washington. Empty lakeside land began to roll by. Roosevelt relaxed with the morning newspapers. Almost every editor in the country, it seemed, approved of his promise to continue, unbroken, the policies of President McKinley. The New York Herald featured an on-the-spot sketch of him taking the oath, hand held high, saying that he deserved golden praise. The Albany Journal and the Washington Post contributed their share of fine ounces. The New York Sun, banner journal of business conservatism, hailed his responsible desire to keep the cabinet intact. Nothing so sobers a man as the possession of great power. The funeral train slowed to 10 miles an hour as it approached Aurora, first village on the line. Farm workers crowded the embankment, doffing their hats to the passing catafalque. Schoolchildren knelt in the cinders, holding up streams of black bunting. Thinly through the hiss of steam and rumble of wheels came the sound of their voices singing, "Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee." The train did not stop. Accelerating again, it moved out of the flat country into a narrow valley splotched with red maple trees. Roosevelt returned to his newspapers. The foreign papers indicated that British opinion was in his favor. Even the Times, which had been critical of him during his bellicose Navy Department days, said that he had great gifts as a leader, and hoped that his impulsiveness was a thing of the past. The Daily Chronicle welcomed him as a benign, if formidable, new force in world affairs. "He believes in a big America. He is an expansionist and an imperialist, but we are safe in thinking that this youngest of presidents will prove one of the greatest." Continental comment was reported to be cooler. Misgivings about Roosevelt's peculiar brand of Pan-Americanism had been expressed in both Paris and St. Petersburg. In Berlin, the Kreuzzeitung feared that the new president might be anti-German. But the Neueste Nachrichten recalled that as a teenager he had lived and studied with a Dresden family. Surely this meant that he would have more sympathy than his predecessors for the Teutonic point of view. On one thing, most nations were agreed. Under Theodore Roosevelt, American sea power was sure to burgeon rapidly. The man who had prepared Admiral Dewey for Manila Bay was unlikely to let the United States Navy remain fifth in the world. Loeb announced the Secretary of War. Roosevelt willingly cast aside his newspapers. Elihu Root was the one person on the train he felt he could talk to freely. Soon both men were deep in conversation, swaying in their seats as the train sped south. About 9:30, its momentum slowed so that a farm boy was able to race it through the fields, waving a flag. The outbuildings of Arcade, New York, came into view, followed by a little railroad station. Almost reluctantly, the train stopped. About 20 Grand Army veterans snapped to attention on the platform. Their ancient tunics looked pinched and trussed, but they held themselves stiff with respect for a fallen comrade. A few much younger soldiers stood to one side. Their uniforms were intimately familiar to Roosevelt. He had worn that khaki himself, hand-tailored by Brooks Brothers, in the Spanish-American War. He drew the blinds, afraid they might salute him rather than McKinley. For 10 minutes, while the locomotive took on water, Roosevelt and Root sat in semi-darkness, listening to the sound of a band playing "Nearer, My God, to Thee." Evidently, they were to hear little else on their long way to Washington. Between strophes, there was a crunch of boots in the gravel, and an old soldier's voice called quaveringly, "We're all heartsore for Major McKinley." Much as Roosevelt coveted the respect of Grand Army veterans, he knew they would never love him as they had loved his predecessor. McKinley had marched with them at Antietam, when T.D. Roosevelt had been but a child in a Zouave suit. A gulf not merely of years, but of ideology, separated him from these heroes of the past. They had fought to preserve the Union. He had fought to create a world power. The old soldiers had cheered when the young soldiers liberated Cuba, but they fell silent when similar freedoms were imposed on Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. They had watched with worried eyes as the Stars and Stripes rose over Hawaii, Wake Island, and half of Samoa, and Secretary Hay began negotiations to purchase the Danish West Indies. Was their beloved republic, they asked, taking on the trappings of an imperial power? The ideological gulf had yawned even wider when the young soldiers persuaded McKinley that occupation of Spain's former colonies should continue well beyond armistice. Cuba and Puerto Rico would need 2 or 3 years to perfect new constitutions and build independent economies. The Philippines would need much longer, half a century perhaps. 7 million largely illiterate tribesmen could not be left to govern themselves without reverting to the laws of the jungle. Powerful commercial, strategic, and moral arguments to this effect had been advanced by the young soldiers, Theodore Roosevelt prominent among them, campaigning for McKinley's re-election. They had trumpeted the islands as new markets for America's superabundant production, cited naval research in favor of a global defense system, and looked to Congress to ensure that America would hold on to what the Supreme Court euphemistically called its unincorporated territories. The old soldiers remained fiercely opposed to expansionism. They asked how a nation that had won its own independence in a colonial war could force dependence upon others. They rejected McKinley's assurance, "No imperial designs lurk in the American mind." So did most intellectuals and Democrats looking for an issue to break the Republican Party. As yet, this anti-imperialist lobby remained a minority, but its members were growing, and its propaganda was powerful. Roosevelt could see the day when it might paralyze his foreign policy. World duties, he felt, were the inevitable and welcome consequence of America's aggrandizing power. Old men and mollycoddles had no understanding of the huge historical forces at work. Just 2 weeks ago in Minnesota, he had dismissed the cliché that all great nations come to dust. "So they have, and so have all others. The weak and the stationary have vanished as surely as, and more rapidly than, those whose citizens felt within them the lift that impels generous souls to great and noble effort. This is only another way of stating the universal law of death, which is itself part of the universal law of life. While the nation that has dared to be great, that has had the will and the power to change the destiny of the ages, in the end must die, it really continues, though in changed form, to live forevermore." His vision was too grandiose to be merely territorial. He had no interest in square miles as such. Expansion to him meant a hemispheric program of acquisition, democratization, and liberation. Cuba, for example, was already eligible for freedom, of sorts, and should have it, in a way, as soon as Congress worked out a policy for tariff reciprocity with the island. Puerto Rico was semi-independent, in the sense that Secretary Root had ended the military government there and given most powers to a native legislature. The real problem was what to do about the Philippines. "Sometimes," Roosevelt confessed, "I feel it is an intensely disagreeable and unfortunate task, which we cannot in honor shirk." Clearly, a vast, primitive archipelago, divided by 7,000 waterways, 70 dialects, and the world's most mutually incompatible religions, Christianity and Islam, needed an authoritarian government to hold it together. If not America's, whose? There were also reasons of strategy to consider. Given half a chance, base-hungry powers such as Germany or Japan would annex and enslave the islands in perpetuity. The United States could at least be trusted not to hold them a day longer than democratic scruples required. President McKinley's enduring ambition was noble, yet Filipinos seemed ungrateful. Rebellion had been raging on the archipelago for almost 2 years. Root needed a 70,000-man army to control it. Some measure of peace had at last been achieved. Today's papers were blessedly free of bad news from over there. But neither Roosevelt nor Root cared to speculate what nice, clean-cut American boys were doing to keep that peace. The train began to move again. Root took his leave, and Roosevelt finished going through the newspapers. Great Britain offered sincere expressions of sympathy to the bereaved United States. No doubt the sympathy was sincere. An Anglo-American rapprochement had been underway for at least 3 years. Moscow confirmed another plot to assassinate Tsar Nicholas II in Marseille, of all places. One would have expected it rather in Tokyo. The most dangerous current rivalry in the world was that between Russia and Japan. Both powers were circling like wolves about that sick mammoth China. Their first snap and snarl would probably be over the mammoth's Manchurian extremity, Kwantung province. Other wolves were on the prowl, German ones trailing the Russian pack, British behind the Japanese. America had its own open-door trade relations with China to protect, and a corollary pledge to preserve Chinese territorial and administrative integrity. Roosevelt's instinct was to stand watchfully aside for the moment. He might one day have to leap in, as into those hounds in Colorado, and sort out the predators with his bare hands. Worldwide, the balance of power was to his advantage. As long as Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, his likely enemy, he felt, in any foreseeable war, remained preoccupied with the Tsar, and the Tsar and the Meiji Emperor of Japan continued to mass forces around Kwantung, the President of the United States could surely perfect a partnership with King Edward VII to control the Western Hemisphere. Of course, he must do most of the controlling. The United States acknowledged Britain's dominion of Canada. What a pity, he always felt, that President Polk had not taken it all in 1846. But he and